This was going to be a talk that was going to be more for a longer talk on a Thursday night, but I got ill and Valerie nicely stepped in for me. Appreciate that. So parts of that are going to be what I'm going to talk about tonight. So, I mean, anicca or impermanence is probably as seminal a teaching as any teaching in Buddhism and really in life. You don't got to be a Buddhist to get hip to know that you need to get right with change. So the other reason that I was thinking about it, we've been doing these Four Noble Truths deals, talks, and the truth of suffering, part of that is our reactivity to what is, and what is most of the time is anicca. And about how we work with that. So the title at the time, and I'll just use it, was Understanding and Love and anicca. So, again, so you don't have to be a rocket scientist or incredibly perceptive human being to know that change is afoot in a very loud way. So right here, though, in the Sangha, it's very loud right now. Because the changes, the ripple effects of Val's stepping back and my having to step back will have ripple effects on this community. And people are stepping up to take care of that, and it looked like that's being done in a really astute and responsible way based on today's meeting. So I have no worries about that. But yet, things are changing. So it's right here, it's right in our lap, it's right in our face, whatever you want, however you want to put it. And of course, it's in the world always, never more so in the last 2 years. I mean, I'm not going to go into it, but again, that's why you don't have to be that perceptive a human being to know that everything is on fire right now with change. Nothing is what it was. And the ripple effects of that, well, we're dealing with it, and everybody's dealing with it all over the world. Others in ways that are a lot more significant than we are right now, as you know. So it's an opportunity for us here. This is not a concept. It is a concept, but it's seen as one of the seminal teachings that I said, but it's also one of the three characteristics of existence in Buddhist practice. So, right, it's anicca, dukkha, anatta. I personally love the, I don't even like translating them, to be honest with you, but I will. So it would be either impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, suffering, and not self. But for now, I'm just going to talk about the first, because the first really leads to the other two. I mean, again, it's kind of basic, really, in one level. Basically. So it's just not me who says that this is a seminal teaching in this tradition, in all the Buddhist traditions, anicca. So Suzuki Roshi, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center in the 60s. Seminal, another seminal, I'm using that word a lot, a seminal person in the Westernization of Buddhism. So he was asked to put the essence of the Dharma in one phrase. And he said two words. He said, everything changes. That's it. Ajahn Chah, the great Thai forest meditation teacher. He was asked a similar question. And it was more about what he teaches. And he says, I teach uncertainty. So change, uncertainty, unreliability, inconstancy. These are all words that can fit into this umbrella of anicca. You know, it's this underlying energy that never ceases and that flows. And its manifestation in the world is change. So understanding this deeply as an insight, especially in this tradition, which is insight meditation, Vipassana, so a deep understanding of anicca is one of the aha moments we can have. Of course, that aha moment probably comes after years of thinking about, of contemplating it, understanding it, sitting with it, sitting with the experience of it. So it's kind of an intuition. When you get it, when you start to get it, it's kind of born out of this much contemplation and thought, but experienced ultimately in a more direct embodied way. So we do our work. We understand that this is important. We do what we're, you know, we do the study, we do the contemplation, we sit with it, and then something happens one day that we have no control over. But we start to understand things a little bit more. So again, this being seminal teaching, if you go back to the first turning of the wheel, as it's called, the Sutta, when the Buddha shared the Four Noble Truths with his five ascetic friends. One of them was a monk, an ascetic, his name was Kandana. So I'm going to read this. So Kandana, one of the five ascetics that the Buddha shares his with whom he shares his findings, his discovery of the Four Noble Truths, is said to have specifically have gotten it or some part of it. And here is what says, this is what the Blessed One said, and the group of five ascetics were gladdened and approved of his words. And while this exposition was being delivered of the Four Noble Truths, the unvarnished and clear vision of Dharma arose in the venerable Kandana. And he said, or that vision was, in words, whatever has the characteristic to arise, well, all that ceases as well. So whatever arises, ceases. Again, that truth is not said to be the final understanding that leads to the final unbinding or nibbana, but a deep understanding of this supposedly puts you on the way. And it makes sense to me. So that was in the sutta that the Buddha referred to him and said, yeah, bro, you got it. You know, yes, you got it. That's anicca. That's impermanence, right? Whatever rises, falls. Whatever is present becomes absent. It's all process, coming and going, flow. So he got that. So how do we get that? How do we get that? I mean, I already kind of talked a little bit about that, but I'll talk about this sort of for a minute, you know, because anicca covers so much. And as Shannon and I were talking before, is that, you know, how rich all of these topics are. And the longer you're practicing, the deeper it goes, and the more rich it becomes, right? Deeper, more like a tapestry, like a detailed tapestry. So anicca covers anything from the cable guy not showing up, and we got to deal with that frustration. That's anicca. That's change. And I know that one. Most of you know that one. Only lately with me, it's been the CenturyLink guy. Anyhow, but or you go from that, you know, considered relatively mundane, right, to to losing people. And losing things that we thought were stable. We thought we're not going to change. Jobs, health, things we're not ready for. So all the way from the cable guy, and I'm sure there's stuff before the cable guy, you know, more than that, obviously, but to deep loss. This is all part of the same process. All part of this rising and passing away from the chip. So how do we hold the truth of change? When it's not a concept, when it's right here in the lap of our lives. So do we see it through the prism of understanding? Yeah, maybe. Through wisdom. Through reading, through thought, through seeing it and naming it in our own lives in the moment. Ah, That, yes, that's impermanence. That's a Nietzsche. And what about the emotional component as well? Right? So that comes along as the reaction or response to change, loss. How do we hold the grief, pain, despair, annoyance, etc.? I guess in the gravity of all that and the depth of all that and the severity of that and the intensity of all that depends on what it is we're losing, what it is that's changing. So teacher Rebecca Bradshaw, she says that our practice now and always is dealing with our issues with change. I'll say that again. She says that our practice now and always is dealing with our issues with change and how we deal with it when it arises in the moment, because that's how everything arises. That's how everything is. It's in the moment. It's alive. Everything is alive. Now, this wisdom piece, we're seeing it from this global perspective that can lead to an equanimity that can hold pieces of this experience of Anicca. Example of how that's gotten to, or in the monasteries, in the Theravadan monasteries, maybe in other monasteries as well, there's a chant. And I've done it on retreat. And they do this daily, I believe, if not more than once. And it's a chant that's the Anicca Vata Sankara. That you guys know. And basically, when translated, it says, it goes this way. It says, all conditioned things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings the highest happiness. Once again, Anicca Vata Sankara, all conditioned things are impermanent. Their nature is to arise and pass away. To live in harmony with this truth brings the highest happiness. Or brings us a wisdom at some point where we don't hold anything very tightly. Because we know that's the way to suffer. So rather than a clenched fist, maybe at least wisdom, this knowledge means instead of it, we're like, at least we're at it, maybe like that. Maybe we hold our hands open. Maybe we're holding things a little more lightly. And even if you do that, if you feel what a fist feels like, clenched, and then you open it, there's a relief in that. And it's similar to what I'm talking about. But it's hard won, I believe. Because it all depends on what we're releasing, how we're putting this truth in action. There is another translation. It's a little different. It says, all created things are impermanent. Seeing with insight, one becomes disenchanted with suffering. This is the path to purity. So again, it's in a different way. It says the same thing. It's about release. Right? If we become disenchanted with holding, because we know it's a dead end. And over time, we start to let go. Maybe. So, this is a form of equanimity that occurs in this process of wisdom, of understanding anicca, the letting go. So as our understanding of anicca takes root, but is that enough? Is equanimity enough? So in an article by David Lai, Zen teacher, he says, maybe not. The article was how to handle grief when equanimity isn't enough. He writes that we naturally seek stability and security, but the teachings emphasize that everything is impermanent and insubstantial. The world isn't a collection of separate things. It's a confluence of interacting processes. And those processes include you and me and everyone we know, everyone on the screen. So that means there's nothing to cling to and no one to cling. Now that may be a bit to chew, to take a bite and chew on right now. It's worth thinking about. And further on in this article, he goes on to say that it's not enough equanimity. And that ultimately, and this is a very Zen thing, but I like it, feels right, is that what we need to do is not just be equanimous with change, we need to be intimate with it. We need to understand deeply every facet of it and how it affects our world and how it affects us, because us and our world are the same. So he said that, Suzuki Roshi again, and I love this, he said that non-attachment, not clinging, not isn't about getting rid of things. It's accepting that they pass away. I just love that, because that feels less mechanical to me. Sounds more like a process. And I'm sure we can have insights, we have them, and boom, we get some. And then tomorrow, it's not there. And we're still who we were the day before. But something has deepened. I don't want to make light of that. But ultimately, it is a process. How we come to terms with anicca in our life. It also says that in this process, part of it is emotion. Not just intellectual, not just, again, wisdom. The heart is involved. So these two wings of practice, wisdom and compassion. Now, Thich Nhat Hanh calls them love and understanding. I kind of like that better. Well, understanding and love. Yeah. So there's also a poignancy we share in a world and a universe of change. So I'm going to read a couple of poems that are more signify that or speak to that. Both Zen hermits, they're hermit poets. One is Ryokan. He says, although from the beginning I knew the world is impermanent, not a moment passes when my sleeves are dropped. Read it again. Although from the beginning I knew the world is impermanent, not a moment passes when my sleeves are dry. You know, at first I didn't get it, but then I got it. It's from wiping away the tears, right? It's from wiping away the tears. That's poignancy. I love this. This is by Issa, another hermit poet. And this was written after the death of his young daughter. Change, extreme change. This world of dew is but a world of do. And yet, I think that's my favorite. So this world of do is but a world of do. And yet. Yeah. So it takes a lot. What is it? You're getting used to this idea in its totality. So I'm running out of time here. As I told you, this talk was meant for 45 minutes anyhow. So I'm gonna say two other things and then stop it. One is there was one of the great articles, Norman Fisher, who's a Zen teacher, who was just a great human being, wrote an article years ago called Impermanence is Buddha Nature. I won't go into that, but in there, he basically talks about the Parinibbana Sutta when the Buddha dies. So you have, he says, half the monks are like going, oh yeah, man, the Nietzsche, impermanence, I get it. And the other half are pulling their hair out and mashing their teeth. They're going like, how can I go on? You know, the master is gone. And basically what he says, and I think this is right, is that we flow between the two. You know, there are moments of both. Probably more mashing of teeth early on. But it's part of the process. I always love that. There is a story about my mother. So my mother passed away. Let me see, now it's about 12, 14 years ago, I forget. Now, my mother was 88 years old when she passed away. But for the last 9 years of her life, she lived in a nursing home in Orlando, Florida. She had suffered multiple mini strokes when she lived alone after my father had passed away. They had a condo in West Palm Beach. My brother's family was in Orlando. I went down there, and when she was found, alone on the floor and basically went to a place and then a hospital. And then we got her put in this nursing home in Orlando. And it was worked out as well as those things work out because it was close to my brother and his family. So her son and his grandparents and his grandkids, her grandkids. It worked out okay. So every year I would go and visit. At least once, tried twice a year to get down there and visit her. Every time I would go in there, regardless of what shape she was in, she'd see me and go and would light up. She'd light up, she knew it was me. Well, the last time I went, she didn't. And she didn't know much of anything. So that really got me, you know, in my heart, that experience of it. I could tell that, you know, it probably wasn't going to be long. So what had happened was I got a call, you know, a number of months later, and she had passed. And what was going on in my life was I may not have dealt so much with my parents' demise, but I dealt with my in-laws' demise every minute of that, because they lived here, my wife's parents. So at that same moment, my father-in-law was going to be changing assisted living facilities. And the truth of it is I didn't want my wife to go through that alone. And my father-in-law was an interesting character. So if anything could be made about as bad as it could be made, he would make it there. So I decided I wasn't going to go. I did not go to my mother's funeral, even though I made sure I was on the phone for it and had some input. So I heard it, but I couldn't do it. Anyhow, I'm getting to the end. So the bottom line was that I was more on the business side of this. My brother was more hands-on. His family, he had passed away already. My brother's been dead almost 20 years. So he was already passed. But his family took good care of my mom. And So she was, her body was sent to Long Island where my father was. And again, I couldn't be there. But what happened was, again, I was on the business side of this. So basically, all the loose ends, business-wise, I was taking care of that. So there was a lot of stuff to take care of at that point. And I did it. And it was done. You know, and consciously, I didn't give much thought to any of this. Again, you know, in my mind, I had, you know, my sense of my mother was as an 88-year-old woman who was had dementia or and multiple strokes, and that was my sense of it, and I was putting that to rest. One day, I was meditating in the room that I meditate. Not long after, but when everything had subsided, when the business stuff was done and all that stuff was done. You know, we have pictures in there. My wife has always been good about that, of ancestors. You know, my grandmother, you know, all these pictures, wonderful pictures of my parents as young people and all that. Anyhow, I was meditating and I opened my eyes and there was this picture of my mother with my father on their wedding day. And then I had a vision of another picture that was not up, but there of my mother was a young woman with three kids. Of course, that was my brother and my sister and me. And all of a sudden, I saw this woman who was a person, not an addle-brained 88-year-old, but a woman who had a life. And she was, you know, my life. She made me. And at that moment, I fell down on the floor and I sobbed like a little baby, which I had not done. And I was amazed at what was happening. I had no control over this. I was not in control of this in the slightest. What then happened was I had this incredible desire at that time. If I could take all of my friends and all the people I cared about and hug them and never let go of them, I would do it. It was this bizarre feeling that I wanted to hold on to everything and everyone that I cared about. And of course, that was impossible. And it took me a number of years to work with them. I would speak to Buddhist teachers about it. And they would say, well, this is an event. You know, they would say it's an event. So, you know, an Anicca event. But they said, well, maybe you ought to do another retreat or something. You know, they didn't tell me how to get past it because they couldn't. And the only way I could get past it was to go deeper or just live with it and let it have its imprint on me. And it did. And I don't feel that way anymore. I don't feel like I have to hold the world close to me because I can't. It's not a possibility. They're all going to go. You're all going to go. I'm going to go just like my mother did. But that was part of that process. So that process was not intellectual in any way, shape, or now this is my process. This doesn't have to be your process. Right? But it left something right here in the middle of my chest, a knowing. And in the way I look at it, it's the meeting point of love and understanding. So that when now, when something like that, or I hear about somebody's passing, or I hear about something that rings true like that to that experience, I can hold that right here and go, And I can feel compassion, care, sadness. I can feel it all, but not in a way that's debilitating, because it was debilitating when it first hit me. So it needed time to metabolize. That's a nice word we use these days in the West, isn't it? So it took time for me to integrate all of that into my being. And it is. So I believe that was a process of metabolizing, understanding, loving the Nietzsche. And helps with the ability not to hold on, to hold on less. So the other thing is, I think in this process that the Sangha is going to go through here, that we need to do both. We need to hold the understanding in our heart, in our heads, that this is just a process that happens to all of us, every institution, every organization change. It's already happened to our Sangha 40,000 times. I don't know, right, Sandy? So I don't know how many times we've been through. And some of us are still around. But also there's an emotional content to various people that we care about. We may not see them as much anymore. So we have to work with both aspects, because they're both real. They're both real.